Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us. The Pentagon is proposing to cut back production of the Bradley fighting vehicle. We're going to look at what that could mean for the Michigan companies that make parts for the Bradley. Then, who wins and who loses when a major freeway is widened right through urban neighborhoods? And we look at the local food scene in Grand Rapids and see just how food builds a sense of place. But first, there's been plenty to celebrate in terms of sales for the U.S. car companies, bouncing back in a big way from their near-death experiences. But strong sales have the automakers and their suppliers boosting production at a very fast rate, and that could be having an unwanted effect with shrinking levels of customer satisfaction. Here to talk about the latest survey by the American Customer Satisfaction Index is company founder Klaus Fornell. Now, your latest survey was done from early April to late May. Sales were terrific. What about customer satisfaction?
Not so terrific. I mean, yeah, they're still, customer satisfaction is still high relative to other products that we measure. But they are, in fact, declining across the board. This is true for domestics as well as imports. It's probably due to capacity constraints. That many of these plants are running at not 24 hours a day, but close to it. And that is not easy to do. So whatever short-term success we have in sales now may be cause problems later on.
So it's coming at a price. So five of the eight domestic brands saw a decline. Which five took a hit?
The biggest hits, and let's just talk about those, because sometimes when it's 1% or 2%, it doesn't really matter much. Mm-hmm. But Buick, which is surprising, has been a strong brand in the past, declined quite a bit. And Jeep and Chevrolet, not so surprising, because they usually do less well in these types of measures. All decline. Now, there is an import, which is also a surprise that it's declining, that is BMW.
BMW, I was going to ask you about that, down 4.7%, not quite as bad as Buick's hit of 5.7%. But, yeah, what's going on at BMW?
Well, you know, I wish I knew.
Yeah.
I think they may be capacity constrained as well. They've had some quality issues. I think they had some issues where they have to have cars come back for fixing, but it's surprising. Usually, it's a brand that doesn't have too many issues with quality. But I think the overall concern here is not so much that everybody's down more or less. The concern is more for domestics because they are declining at a much more rapid rate than the imports are. And we're now back to a gap in customer satisfaction that is the highest we've seen in 5 years. The reason that's important here is that all automobile companies rely on repeat business. And if you have satisfied customers, repeat business is much easier to get. If your customers are not so satisfied, you have to resort to other means to get them back. And we've seen Detroit do that before with price promotions and the like.
And I'm kind of interested in when you are doing your survey, just what is it that customers aren't satisfied with?
Well, this time it is actually quality for the most part. We can only assume here, of course, but it seems to be more than a coincidence that it happens when supply is so constrained that most of these plants are near capacity or actually a bit over capacity, that mistakes are made.
Now, I do note that Ford did all right. There was no change for Ford. And then GMC up 6.3. To what do you attribute that?
Well, I hope it's more than luck. It's true. There are some companies that are actually doing better in this environment. Mercedes is one, Honda is another, GMC also, and Chrysler. But GMC and Chrysler, when I say Chrysler in this particular context, it means the Chrysler nameplate.
Yes.
And then Jeep is owned by Chrysler as well, and they're not doing
well. In fact, Jeep and Dodge both took a hit. So what should Chrysler brass take from looking at this survey and looking at those customer satisfaction scores for Jeep and Dodge?
Well, the first thing is obviously not to panic too much, but I think this is a warning signal. It's also the fact, if you look at the sales figures, they all look strong for Detroit, but they're even stronger for the imports. In fact, both Ford and Chrysler are losing market share to imports at the moment. So it's not quite as good as it may seem at first glance. And to do well in the future, I think you just have to make sure that you have satisfied customers. And if you don't, then it's just going to be more costly to get that repeat business.
Well, there is such a rush now among the U.S. carmakers now that they're out of the Great Recession and sales are strong. There's a real rush to get new product out into the showrooms with a lot of planned new launches. Lead times are shortened and suppliers are really jamming, trying to meet demand. We've already seen Chrysler announce revised timing on that big introduction. And then there's that traditional wisdom, don't buy a model during the first year, let them iron out the bugs. So when you factor all of this in, could we see customer satisfaction take a bigger hit?
Well, that's a fear, right? And I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. And I don't want to go back, and I think nobody does who lives in Michigan, to the times where this happened to our domestic car industry. We've sort of seen this movie before, and I don't think we want to see it again.
Klaus Fornell is the founder of the American Customer Satisfaction Index, and he spoke to us today from their offices in Ann Arbor. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
There's a dead zone in Green Bay. Now, that may sound like the title of a Stephen King novel, but it is happening in Lake Michigan's Green Bay, a growing dead zone with so little oxygen that fish can't survive. Don Scavia joins us now. He's an aquatic ecologist with the University of Michigan, and he directs the Graham Sustainability Institute. It's very good to have you back on Stateside, Don.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, we last spoke with you in the spring about Lake Erie and its algae bloom, and we know there's a dead zone that you've been watching for a long time in Lake Erie's Central Basin. How worrisome is the dead zone that's showing up in Green Bay?
Well, it's worrisome. It's the same kinds of problems that we're worrying about in Lake Erie, and to be honest, Chesapeake Bay and the Gulf of Mexico. These are really important problems. Fisheries in all four of those areas are really important, and they're threatened.
Is it growing? Is that what's kind of triggering this new wave of concern?
I think that's the case, that, you know, as in other places, the loads of the nutrients that tend to drive these problems are increasing. We also have a new phenomenon with these intense storms that we're getting in the spring, this sort of climate-induced variability that we are not used to, driving the problems even farther.
So break it down for us. Just give us the dead zone 101, if you will. Exactly what is it and what causes it?
Sure. So as you said in the beginning, the dead zone is an area in a water body that has oxygen that has become so low that any fish that are in that area that can swim away will, and they'll leave. They'll go to other areas, and those organisms that live in the bottom will in fact die. It's caused by the decomposition of organic material, organic matter that gets down into the bottom waters, and the bacteria that decompose it use up the oxygen. Most of the organic matter that gets down to the bottom is the algae that we see at the surface, and that algae is driven by the nitrogen and the phosphorus loads that come off the land and stimulate those algae blooms.
What's happening around Green Bay, Don, as far as where's the phosphorus runoff likely coming from?
Well, the dominant source of the phosphorus in that watershed is agriculture. There's always, you know, municipal and industrial sources that are of concern, but, you know, the Clean Water Act and the point source control of those treatment plants has brought those phosphorus concentrations down, and we're pretty much left with what's coming off of the agricultural lands as the primary control mechanism that we have left.
So what could farmers do to perhaps reduce the impact and control that runoff?
Well, there's a range of practices that are actually primarily supported by the Farm Bill when we have one.
There's a discussion.
There's another discussion, exactly. But, you know, planting buffer strips between the farm field and the adjacent streams is one way that helps prevent erosion and the loss of phosphorus into the land, creating and protecting wetlands in those areas, controlling how much water flows off of that land through the drain tiles, the drain fields, is another way. These are all not farming marginal lands that require more fertilizer than other places. And you know, these all cost farmers money to do that, and that's where the Farm Bill becomes so important, because that's where the incentive comes from to do the right conservation programs.
How about controlling cattle manure? What can farmers do to deal with that?
Well, you know, it used to be when you had a small farms, you took the cattle manure and you spread it on your own land and you grew corn and you fed your cows and you had a nice little cycle. Well, that doesn't happen anymore, and we have much larger operations. And so, managing the manure, finding ways to keep it on the land, keep it into the lagoons if you're using those, and not having that leach into the groundwater and into the surface drainage is really important.
Is there a sense of concern and cooperation from the agricultural community around Green Bay?
You know, I don't know the Green Bay community that well.
Okay.
But the Ohio community, where we actually have been dealing quite a bit with Lake Erie, there's been a tremendous growth in cooperation in that area. And I think it may be safe to think that, you know, Great Lakes agricultural communities have a lot in common.
Realizing there's so much at stake.
Right. What's really sort of, I think, interesting and useful in some ways in the Great Lakes region, as opposed to the Gulf of Mexico, where the nutrients in this are coming from Iowa, and getting it into the Gulf. You know, these farmers fish, and so they want to protect the Great Lakes as much as the rest of us.
Don Scavia is an aquatic ecologist with the University of Michigan, and he's the director of the Graham Sustainability Institute, keeping an eye on the dead zone that's shown up in Green Bay. Don, thanks so much, as always, for talking with us.
Thank you.
Still to come, we look at the Grand Rapids food scene and find out how it's building up the community. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Whenever there's conversation and debate about Washington's bloated budgets and out-of-control federal spending, the Defense Department is frequently in the spotlight. Well, now as the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan wind down, and in face of demands to cut back spending, the Defense Department is proposing to do just that by cutting back on something that could hit Michigan companies and hit them hard. Todd Spangler covers Washington for the Detroit Free Press, and he joins us now from D.C. Welcome back to the program, Todd.
Thanks for having me, Cynthia.
So the program on the bubble is the Bradley Fighting Vehicle. Tell us about this vehicle.
Well, this is one of the military vehicles that have, it's iconic across the military, been used since the 1980s, been updated, obviously, through the years. But it's one that, you know, has suppliers and manufacturers all over the country, and Michigan would be hit pretty hard by it if it were to stop production, as they're talking about.
And why are they looking at the Bradley? Is there talking about shutting down production and tapering things off? Why is the Bradley on in their sights?
They're actually looking at replacing a lot of the Bradleys with an updated, a new ground combat vehicle in the years to come, but it's not really ready to go. So what they're really looking at this point, as they wind down things, is how many do they need to keep going? They still need a bunch. They still need, several thousand around just to keep the Army supplied. But for now, they're talking about, at least the president's budget calls for stopping production for the next 3 years.
And what would that mean here in Michigan?
In Michigan, what the main supplier, the maker of this BAE system, says is that about 1,000 people in Michigan are attached to the Bradley, either directly as suppliers or suppliers who supply suppliers. And that's about 46 different companies. And the argument is that if this were to go away, you might see as many as 1,000 workers lose their jobs.
And that with this idea that, well, let's stow the Bradley for 3 years and then come back to it, what would that mean in terms of this, of the kinds of workers needed to build that thing?
Right. That's really the argument that the suppliers are making, is that if this business goes away for 3 years without any kind of government help to keep them afloat, they're just going to disappear. A lot of these workers are going to get laid off. A lot of them are going to go to other industries. And that when, after those 3 years, if that happens and the government says, okay, we need more of this, we're not as far along on these other vehicles as we thought we were going to be, that's going to cost a whole lot more money then to get them restarted. That it costs $600-700 million just to get the whole line restarted again.
So is there some kind of a compromise? Would there be a way, is there a discussion of keeping a trickle of production going enough to keep the suppliers up and running?
Absolutely, yeah. What they're talking about this year, and it looks like they've got some kind of deal mostly worked out, is to spend about $140 million that wasn't spent last year on upgrading several of the Bradleys that have been used as scout vehicles that they need for as combat vehicles. Just doing that much will keep the suppliers working enough that the 2014 doesn't sound like it'll be a bad year for those suppliers. They're beginning to get more concerned now about 2015 and 2016 if the line were to shut down then.
It does point out the dilemma that, you know, cause and effect. We certainly hear calls to cut federal spending, and that means in doing so, somebody's going to get pinched. And being perfectly objective, one could ask what makes Michigan and these companies exempt from that.
Absolutely. It's a perfect question to ask. And honestly, I mean, the contractors are pretty smart about how they spread out a lot of their work because they know that if something's going to come down the pike cutting them, they can quickly raise these suppliers to come down to Congress and say, listen, these are actual jobs that are going to get lost. It's always a question when you start cutting the government budget, who's going to get hurt. I mean, there are usually jobs at the other side of this in one way or another. And you're right. I mean, if there's going to be a military drawdown, somebody's going to get hurt.
What should we watch for then? What kind of timetable are we looking at, Todd?
I think probably right now is that as we move toward some kind of at least partial budget agreement.
Would hope.
yeah, later in September. I mean, to at least keep government funded, one would hope. I think there'll be some kind of move to keep some money in there for this for the short term. But ultimately, what's going to happen in 2015 and 2016 is really going to depend on whatever this larger answer is about sequester, and that's anybody's guess at this point.
Todd Spangler, the Washington reporter for the Detroit Free Press. Todd, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, let's talk food. Delicious, fresh, healthy, local food. Well, there, we got your attention. That is the mission of Lisa Rose Starner, to get as many of us as possible to eat local. And there's plenty of that happening in Grand Rapids, from community gardens to microbreweries to food entrepreneurs and artisans and so much more. Lisa was invited to tell the many stories of the Grand Rapids local food scene, and the result is her book, Grand Rapids Food, A Culinary Revolution. Lisa Rose Starner joins us now from the studios of WGVU in Grand Rapids. Hey, Lisa.
Hey, Cindy.
So why do you describe the local food movement in Grand Rapids as a revolution?
I've been working in the Grand Rapids community now for about 11 years, primarily with local food artisans, farmers, chefs, students, teaching them how to grow and cook food. And part of my own journey, it's sort of a participant, observer. It's really changing the way we not only eat, but relate to one another and how we get together as a community and how really we are making change in our community in a really deep and profound way that just beyond the table.
So, and food is the catalyst for that change.
Absolutely. Food, it's not just having a wonderful meal and sharing it with friends. Of course, that's a fantastic thing, but it's the connection that we make both to the food as it can nourish us, but to the land that it comes from, and then to one another as growers and just as friends.
Give us, if you can, kind of a history. What are the roots and the beginnings of the local food movement in Grand Rapids?
Well, I think if you look stepping back out further than Grand Rapids, the local food movement has been underway for about 35 years across the United States, having roots both on the East and West coasts, and then certainly in the larger metropolitan areas of trying to reconnect to the local food system, which had become quite decentralized, switching to industrial agriculture, large-scale producers.
Sure.
To feed the needs for the supply chain for the global food trade that we have now. And in Grand Rapids, I'm originally from West Michigan and moved away after school to the Bay Area in Napa Valley and in Berkeley. And, of course, we all know that their food community there is vibrant. You can grow things, year-round.
Sure.
And coming back to Michigan and particularly Grand Rapids in 2001, the community was just starting to talk about how do we really reconnect the community to where their food comes from. How do we really make sure that our farmers markets, how we can grow our farmers markets, how we can have growers right around us be able to thrive and have vibrant and financially viable farms that grow healthful and nutritious foods that in a sustainable way that is really in good care of our local Michigan land, the wonderful Great Lakes watershed that we have. And so, looking ahead now to 2013, there's really been this groundswell nationally, an interest of everyone really being concerned about health and wellness, environmental stewardship. You know, moms just want to make sure the food they're putting on their plates is safe and not contaminated and not dangerous. And
sure.
They just really want to take back their dinner table for their families. And we're finally starting to see some of the work pay off of over the long, the long past decade. And the farmers markets are growing. More and more people are starting community gardens. And individuals are seeing the change that they can make in their own community, just themselves, and trying to make their own place where change can happen.
And you tell many, many stories in your book, Grand Rapids Food. You introduce us to so many people who are part of the local food scene. So for instance, I'd like you to talk to us about Aaliyah French, because here's someone who's building a reputation as a food artisan, and Aaliyah is 17 years old.
She is now a senior at one of the local high schools here in Grand Rapids. And Aaliyah is, being a woman myself and having the luxury of having had mentors and really strong women to look up to, I look at Aaliyah and I see someone that has so much potential, and she's so excited. She's a pie maker. Who doesn't love pie?
Absolutely.
Who doesn't love pie, right? So this young woman has a tremendous aptitude for pastry and for cooking. And it's actually in her bloodlines. Her great-grandmother from down south was well known for her crusts and her baked goods. And Aaliyah, over time, started making her pastries and pies more regularly. And her mother, love our moms, got her into one of our local commercial kitchens. And this really gave the Uptown Kitchen, which is in the Easttown area. The Uptown Kitchen is a commercial kitchen where food artisans that may not have access to a commercial space themselves can come into the kitchen. It's a certified kitchen. They can prepare their goods, everything from salsas to canned goods to sausages, and in Aaliyah's case, pies, and produce goods that are safe and certified for both the restaurant market and the retail trade.
So it's an incubator.
It is an incubator space. Exactly. So this young woman has had the opportunity to work in a full-scale kitchen and then, get her pies not only at the farmer's market but into the restaurants, and, is looking ahead past college and not really knowing where her culinary focus is going to take her. But she's had this really profound opportunity to launch a business, procure the ingredients. She's extremely proud of her handcrafted work. I mean, if you make something,
sure,
there's an inherent sense of pride. And for Aaliyah, she's really not willing to compromise. She goes to the farmer's market and will purchase local eggs, and from the local eggs to the butter. And of course, if you make a pie crust, it's all about the butter. You don't skimp on the butter, or in some cases lard, depending on how you wish to make your crust.
Sure.
And so Aaliyah, she just is this really creative young woman that, having access to this incubator kitchen, the commercial kitchen at Uptown, has really given her a chance to make her own mark in the community. And that's really, I think, from an economic development standpoint, getting young women excited about being business owners, inspiring the trade. I mean, there's the artisanship. It's about being a tradesperson and having a craft. It's really, I think, awesome to watch.
I'm speaking with Lisa Rose Starner, who's author of the book Grand Rapids Food, A Culinary Revolution. And one of the issues you bring up in your book, Lisa, is the exclusivity of local food movements. It's a criticism lobbed at food movements everywhere. Can you talk a little bit about how that's played out in Grand Rapids and what's being done and who's working to address it?
That's, you bring up one of the really big challenges within the food community, and also, I think, specifically within Grand Rapids. And on a personal level, for me, it's always been more than about being more than being a foodie. It's people will frequently say, "Well, you like food. You've worked in the local food systems. You must be a foodie." And that term, I think, has acquired some connotations of exclusivity, as you
yes.
the word that you used, as though it's all about the high-end meal or dining experience at the exclusive farm-to-table restaurant. And for me, and with this book, to really elevate the conversation to those that might not be as familiar as some of the food justice movement context and some of the issues, to think more, do we all have access to healthful foods, whether you have 50 cents or $50 million, how do we create a community where everyone does have access to foods that we know how to cook together, that we know how to take care of our families? It's really at the core of it, going back to some of the basic principles of knowing how to take care of ourselves. And also making sure we really look at the agriculture system and talk about and have difficult conversations around race, around labor, around migrant work, around immigration, and really talk about that and how does that, you know, within our food system, what are we going to do to make sure that we do have a more fair labor system, that we do create food and grow food in a way that is sustainable and is it promotes the agricultural stewardship that we need to promote and not continue to take away from our natural resources, particularly in Michigan.
Lisa, we have folks right now from Flint to Metro Detroit, across West Michigan, up to Interlochen and Traverse City, all listening to our conversation. Can you share with them what lessons from the Grand Rapids local food movement could the rest of the state learn from?
Well, I've been blessed with having had colleagues in all of those areas. In fact, I've worked up north in Traverse City on a farm. I have great friends doing advocacy work and growing work in Ann Arbor, Ypsilanti, Detroit, and I was born in Flint, and so I have family still downtown and have watched the upcoming food movements and, of course, the urban agriculture really take root in a lot of those areas. And I actually flipped that question on its head in that Grand Rapids can learn a lot from the other communities who are also on a similar but very different trajectory that challenge, that have challenges in terms of resources, in terms of policy challenges. And, you know, I would really like to see a better dialogue happening between the cities and info sharing. That said, what we have to contribute is that in Grand Rapids, this has happened from a very ground-up perspective. We don't have large, significant infrastructure investing into the community gardens, for example. We, you know, lots of these stories that I chose, in fact, actually, my manuscript was twice as long as what actually got printed, so lots of stories.
Oh, so many stories you wanted to tell.
I did, and my publisher said, really, you have to cut it down by half, and I almost cried. it was very difficult, but really thinking, how do we go ahead and talk about the people deciding to do this regardless of the challenges, regardless of the resources. And, you know, in Grand Rapids, I've just personally, I've been here for a while. This is my town. These are my people. Mm-hmm. I was reinvigorated to go back and, you know, gave me a chance to check in with my friends, see how they were doing, to really talk frankly about the challenges. And then to hear that people are continuing to chip away regardless of some of the huge barriers. And, you know, I think that from my perspective, there is a certain dedication in Grand Rapids. It's, I guess, if you will, it's the bootstrapping. People continue to make it happen. And I think that we still have a long way to go here in Grand Rapids. And so, to your question, between up north in Traverse Bay, even up to the UP, they have a short growing season.
Sure do.
there are lots of great things happening in terms of season extension and high tunnel hoop houses that have given a lot of farmers, whether you're in Flint or out up north or in the Bay Area of Michigan, to extend the growing season, increase the market efforts, getting fresh foods into the schools. You know, we continue to chip away at some of these things, and there can be a lot that can happen faster, I think, if we continue the information share between the cities.
Author Lisa Rose Starner's book is Grand Rapids Food, A Culinary Revolution, looking at that growing local food movement in West Michigan. Thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside, Lisa.
Thank you for having me.
And Lisa Rose will be talking at the Grand Rapids Public Library on August 29th, a conversation with urban food innovators around new food and farming business development. For more information, just visit her website, GrandRapidsFoodACulinaryRevolution.com. And up next, the pros and cons for expanding I-94 in Detroit. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Earlier this summer, the Southeast Michigan Council of Governments, SEMCOG, adopted something called the 2040 Regional Transportation Plan. Basically, it's a roadmap of how to spend $36 billion over the next 30 years to improve transportation in Southeast Michigan. Well, of all the proposed improvements in this plan, the most controversial has been the renovation and expansion of I-94 and I-75. The price tag to expand and renovate these Detroit-area freeways is around $4 billion. But critics say the proposal, especially the I-94 project, would force neighbors to pay a different price. Megan Owens is the executive director of Transportation Riders United, and Megan joins us now from Detroit. Welcome to Stateside.
Hello.
So the I-94 proposal is basically calling to expand the freeway between Connor to I-96 in Detroit. Price tag $2.7 billion in federal and state bonds. Why do you oppose this expansion?
Well, we have no problem with the repairing and rebuilding of that highway because it certainly is old. But the reality is our population as a region is not growing. The number of miles we're traveling is not growing. We can barely afford to maintain the roads we have. It really doesn't make sense to be spending so much money to widen highways and add more lane miles. That money would be much better spent on repairing the roads we have or looking at transportation alternatives like public transit.
I will say, having driven I-94 a lot through the years, it does seem that it just jams up a lot. And it always made me wonder, as a driver, if they widened this thing, would it be better? So is that a fair question to ask?
That is certainly something everyone sitting in a traffic jam always wonders. But when researchers have looked at it, there's this concept called induced demand that whenever you widen a highway or a roadway, it just invites more people to utilize it. And within a couple of years, almost all of that new lane mile area is being utilized, is filled up with more traffic. So it really actually doesn't help to widen highways. We've seen highways get wider and wider, and yet the traffic continues.
I guess all I have to say is the Dan Ryan Freeway to anybody who's driven in Chicago. I guess you're right when you think of how many lanes wide that is and how often that's gridlocked.
Absolutely. Or L.A. certainly has a lot of examples. But they've started choosing to invest in alternatives, giving people other ways to get around than just their highways.
Such as?
Well, they've been making major investments in their public transit system. They've, even in another very auto-oriented city, they've made major investments in their bus system, in new rail lines, they're actually building a subway. You didn't realize anyone was building those these days, but they are making major investments in giving people other ways to get around than just their cars, and that's starting to pay off.
But aren't there restrictions on how that federal money for the project could be used?
Yes. In this case, we can't just transfer the money directly from this highway project to public transit. But as a region and as a state, we certainly could be making choices to make investments in transportation in a different way.
Certainly, the issue of transportation in Southeast Michigan, it goes back decades, the fact that there really isn't a unified system. And I know there's movement toward that. But back to what could be done with this money. Are there alternative ways to use those funds available for the project?
Well, I'm sure every one of us could point at some roadways that need to be repaired, potholes that need to be filled. And so if we could take even the 20% of this cost that is designed for, that is allocated for the widening portion, that's hundreds of millions of dollars that could be spent repairing roads that we already have so that they're in better shape, so we're not getting so many flat tires from potholes and so much difficulty in that way. That's certainly something that's needed all across the region of the state.
We're speaking with Megan Owens. She's the executive director of Transportation Riders United, and kind of uniting the criticism about a plan to expand I-94 through the city of Detroit, basically from Connor to I-96. And with the plan, MDOT talks about getting rid of the old left-hand exits, widening with another lane in each direction, widening the service drives. What do your studies show, Megan, would be the toll on the neighborhoods along 94 between Connor and I-96?
Well, that's another huge impact. This is actually one of the few growing areas in the Midtown Detroit area where there's a lot more people moving in and who want to get around without always having to use a car. But they're proposing to tear out numerous bridges, including pedestrian overpasses, that would actually make it dramatically more difficult for people to get around.
And what about lost homes? What do you project would happen if they do go ahead and follow through with the plan to not only widen the lanes but also widen the service drives?
There would not only be dozens of homes lost, but also a building that's very historic in the Motown music history, a very popular school would be either destroyed or at least significantly impacted. There are a number of additional local impacts that would really hit the community very hard.
Now, there is, Megan, some real history associated with freeway building in Detroit. What did the initial freeway construction around the city, whether you're talking the Ford Freeway or I-96, the Jeffries, what did it do to African-American neighborhoods?
It really devastated them. There were some very successful and popular neighborhoods back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s that ended up being completely devastated by, and ultimately destroyed by having highways plowed right through the middle of them. And in addition to the actual paving over of homes and neighborhoods, it also really facilitated the exodus from Detroit, making it much easier for people to live further out and have a quick commute into their jobs in the city. But that ended up really just spurring further development further and further out and enabling a lot of the sprawl and the paving over of green spaces, wetlands, and farmlands in the suburban areas.
Well, SEMCOG has adopted the 2040 Regional Transportation Plan. What comes next? What should we watch for?
This is a long-range plan, and every couple of years they do a shorter-term plan that looks at the next 3 to 5 years. So there still are definitely opportunities for people to weigh in if they have concerns about the direction of, again, spending almost $4 billion on widening highways. If you want to see those invested elsewhere, contact SEMCOG. Let them know. Contact MDOT. Contact your elected leaders and let them know what you want to see in terms of a transportation system. There will be a lot of choices, a lot of opportunities coming up in the next months and years to decide what Michigan's transportation future is going to be. This is definitely not the last word.
Megan Owens is the executive director of Transportation Riders United, and she spoke with us from their offices in Detroit. Megan, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Let's turn now to MDOT and find out why they believe this expansion of I-94 and I-75 is needed. We're joined now by Rob Morosi of the Michigan Department of Transportation. Hello, Rob.
Hi, Cindy. How are you?
I'm great. So, Rob, how do you respond to groups like Transportation Riders United, the critics who say, sure, spend money to repair and rebuild, but if the population of the region isn't growing and we can hardly maintain the highways we do have, why widen and add more lanes?
Well, I think it's twofold. First and foremost, the need. The need is there for I-94. You're looking at a corridor 7 miles that was constructed between 1947 and 1958. Really needs to be modernized. Everybody's calling this a widening project. Really, in true essence, it is a modernization project. We need to really modernize the freeway, lengthen, create acceleration, deceleration lanes, improve mobility, but more importantly, improve safety.
So, Rob Morrissey, as it's planned now and as the project stands, how will a driver see a different I-94? If we're crossing along that stretch from Connor to I-96, what will be different after it's modernized?
After it's modernized, the biggest difference is going to be the comfort level for the driver. You are going to have, again, you're going to have extended acceleration and deceleration lanes. You're going to have brand new overpasses. You're going to have a completely remade 94 Lodge interchange, removing those outdated left lane exits and entrance ramps and replacing them with standard right lane movements. I think the drivers are also going to see widened shoulders, more area to pull off if there's an incident in front of you, or if your vehicle is encountering some sort of malfunction the way it operates.
Will there be more lanes?
There will be an additional through lane in each direction. There will be one lane and eastbound, westbound. That's a through lane from 96 all the way over to Connor.
Okay, because there was a lot of talk about that induced demand, that traffic will just expand to fit whatever road capacity is there. So we're still going to see traffic jams after there's that extra lane? Is there some merit to that?
Well, we're not building freeways like they have in Los Angeles. I mean, we're going from three through lanes to four through lanes. Yes, there will be continuous service drives, which need to be built. But we're not looking at a massive, expansive freeway. So anytime you live in a major metropolitan area and you are hitting the commute times, the heavy times, the morning and afternoon rush, you are going to see some delays. This is not the end-all, be-all. You are not going to go from Grosse Pointe to Comerica Park in, you know, half the time without ever hitting your brakes. That's not going to happen. But what this project is going to do is, again, improve safety. I think that's the one thing that I really hope people understand is the safety aspect. When you look from January 1st, 2008 to December 31st, 2012, our latest five-year crash data, more than 4,800 crashes in 5 years on that 6.7-mile stretch. The reason being, it's outdated and it needs the modernization.
I'm speaking with Rob Morrissey of the Michigan Department of Transportation, looking at the planned expansion of I-94. And Rob, there is concern about the impact that this is going to have on the neighborhoods, particularly along between Connor and I-96. First of all, why are pedestrian bridges going to be removed? It's going to present hardships for folks who are going to have to walk a lot further to get to a pedestrian bridge.
Right, and we understand that. Some of the pedestrian bridges are being removed not because we want to remove them, but because of the creation of the acceleration and deceleration lanes. So we are looking at a couple pedestrian bridges, Brooklyn over 94, mm-hmm. Canfield over M10, but those are being removed for the complete reconfiguration of the 94 Lodge interchange. A lot of the other pedestrian bridges along I-94, especially from Shane to Connor, will remain in place. And a lot of these overpasses will be built to modern standards, which will include a 5-foot bike lane and 8-foot sidewalks protected from vehicle traffic. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of things that we are going to incorporate in this project that not only adapt to the complete streets policy, but also adapt to more modern freeway standards. And there is just as much emphasis on local mobility as there is for freeway mobility. And that is, of course, the creation of the continuous service drives. Right now, if we have an incident on I-94, there's a lot of times the service drives are not through service drives. They dead end into right-of-way fence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we have an incident on the freeway and we need to pull all that traffic off the freeway and that service drive is not continuous, those cars are going through a neighborhood they're not familiar with. I think that's more dangerous. By creating these continuous service drives, that will allow that traffic to exit the freeway, continue again on a dedicated straight-through service drive to the next available ramp to get them around that incident. So I think there is a lot of safety benefits to the local community by the construction of these continuous service drives.
I do want to ask if you can respond to kind of a consistent theme from critics when you read reader reactions to stories online and the like. And that's the big picture concern that this expansion really helps the driver that's going, say, from St. Clair Shores to Detroit Metro Airport, really having nothing to do with supporting or helping the neighborhoods where these freeways run through. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think there's some misunderstanding there. I really think the continuous service drives really do benefit the neighborhoods. I think the new overpasses benefit the neighborhoods. We're talking about connectivity over a freeway for local traffic. These bridges, I mean, we're already up to 7 or 8 in critical condition, 14 in poor condition. So this freeway needs to be rebuilt anyway. This is all about safety in terms of not only for the drivers of the freeway, but for the residents in the local neighborhoods. If you've seen some of these overpasses, there are some sidewalks that are just in very poor condition, pedestrian bridges that are in very poor condition. The other thing I think that really needs to be looked at is the availability for a more multimodal approach in the neighborhood. You can construct service drives with 11-foot lanes, 8-foot shoulder for non-motorized bike lanes, pedestrian access, things of that nature. So, you know, this is not simply about just bringing people from point A to point B on the freeway. I think when you really boil this project down to the nitty-gritty, you are going to see just as many, if not more, benefits for the local community than you would for the freeway drivers themselves.
And remind us of the timetable, Rob. When does it begin, and when will this all be wrapped up?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. It really is. And right now, everyone knows the department is really struggling financially. A lot of uncertainty in our funding now and in the future. We're really targeting to really get going on this maybe as early as late 16, most likely probably 2017 in that area. Now, there's some bridges that are in critical nature that we want to attend to in 2014 as well as 2015.
Rob Morosi is with the Michigan Department of Transportation. Rob, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
My pleasure. It was great talking to you. Have a wonderful day.
About the I-94 expansion or other stories going on in the news. Well, our Stateside team always loves hearing from you. You can easily find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And, of course, the Stateside link at michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside's engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, and Katie Suha. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.